the simple chalk mark announced that the dead drop site at the Pushkinskaya apartment house had been loaded. These standard pieces of tradecraft, the silent call, followed by a signal site marked with an X and dead drop, were part of a COMO plan, codenamed Distant, designed specifically for Penkovsky to provide an early warning of imminent Soviet attack on the West. The small matchbox that Jacob found tethered by wire behind the radiator might have contained information signaling the start of World War III. With the silent call, Penkovsky, who had not been heard from or seen since early September, had apparently reemerged. It was possible that nothing serious was wrong. If it was a trap, a provocation on the part of the KGB, then it was worth the chance. "We had been worried about him. It had been quiet for quite a while," said the case officer who decrypted the message, and whose memories are still vivid after more than four decades. "But in the past, he had come up again. To my knowledge, we had no warning, nothing to indicate they'd caught him." Now, with Jacob's arrest, whatever glimmers of hope that might have existed with Penkovsky's reemergence seemed far-fetched. It was possible that a bystander had seen Penkovsky suspiciously fiddling behind the radiator as he loaded the dead drop and called authorities, who then laid in wait. It was also possible that the KGB had not been fooled by Jacob's cover and defeated his counter-surveillance maneuvers en route to the dead drop site. Any number of other scenarios about Penkovsky's fate was possible, but only a single distressing conclusion was probable. Penkovsky's handlers had grown increasingly troubled by recent events surrounding the operation. Penkovsky had vanished from operational sight for several weeks prior to the silent call, and his GRU superiors abruptly canceled his scheduled trip to Seattle in the autumn of 1962. Additionally, the sheer volume of intelligence he was providing on his Minox film cassettes suggested a level of clandestine activity that could not continue undetected indefinitely. So voluminous was Penkovsky's productivity during the first half of 1962 that his handlers decided to discontinue temporarily tasking him for new intelligence collection. The operation would refocus on supporting his work for the GRU by providing comprehensively written technical articles to be published under his name and supplying harmless intelligence products he could take back to Moscow from trips to the West. The intent was to strengthen Penkovsky's credibility among superiors, raising him above suspicion and moving him into circles of even greater access to Soviet secrets. During a three-month period between October 1961 and January 1962, Penkovsky met with his contact in Moscow, Janet Chisholm, the young wife of British MI6 officer Roderick Chisholm, 11 times in public locations. During these brief encounters, she received 35 rolls of film containing hundreds of images of top-secret Soviet documents. In January, Penkovsky reported what he believed was surveillance on Mrs. Chisholm, but showed no personal alarm. Rather, he suggested that dead drops replace their contacts on the street. Early successes, it seemed, emboldened Penkovsky, but in his handler's opinion, the agent's level of productivity was alarming as well as gratifying. Had Penkovsky dropped his guard or grown careless as the inherently dangerous work became routine? It was possible. Had he grown to feel invulnerable and above suspicion? That, too, was possible. It only became known much later that George Blake, an MI6 officer who spied for the Soviets, alerted the KGB that Janet Chisholm was actively supporting her MI6 husband in operations. Consequently, when the couple arrived in Moscow, KGB surveillance teams were waiting for them. Confirmation of the disaster arrived a few hours after the first message, with the news of the arrest of Greville Wynne, a British businessman traveling in Hungary. A sometime contact between Penkovsky and his handlers, Wynne was arrested by a KGB team in Budapest, also on November 2nd, and flown back to Moscow. The final curtain fell a month later. On December 12th, a notice in the Soviet newspaper Pravda announced Penkovsky's arrest in late October, more than a week before Jacob's apprehension. 6 months later, on May 7, 1963, Penkovsky stood in a courtroom before the same judge who had presided at the trial of Francis Gary Powers, the American pilot whose U-2 spy plane had been shot down in May 1960 over Sverdlovsk. The trial lasted 4 days. Penkovsky, in an attempt to save his life, admitted that he had passed secrets to the Americans and British. Prosecutors cited moral degradation among the reasons for his traitorous acts, while a witness bolstered this claim by testifying that he had seen the defendant sipping wine from a woman's shoe during a night of heavy drinking. On May 17th, a public notice appeared that Penkovsky had been executed. Rumors about his death eventually began to leak out. While the Soviet press announced an execution by firing squad, another unconfirmed report claimed that he had been burned alive in a crematorium and the grisly episode filmed as a warning to new GRU officers who might someday consider cooperating with the West. Wynne was also tried, found guilty, and sentenced to 8 years in prison. He was released in 1964 as part of a spy swap for Gordon Lonsdale, a Soviet spy convicted in Britain. Like a silent explosion, the capture, trial, and execution of Penkovsky sent shockwaves of uncertainty, recrimination, and retribution through American, British, and Soviet intelligence circles. While the badly burned Soviets restructured the GRU, the British and Americans, uncertain about when and how Penkovsky was first identified, faced a flood of questions. If Penkovsky was under KGB suspicion as early as December of 1961 or January of 1962, did this mean the Soviets manipulated the information he provided? If so, when did he begin reporting controlled information designed to mislead American and British analysts? For that matter, could anything he reported be trusted? Material long disseminated by analysts to policy officials was recalled and painstakingly re-examined. The eventual conclusion was that the Soviets had not played Penkovsky back against the Americans and British, but that left unanswered the mystery of why, if Penkovsky was suspected as early as December 1961, the Soviets continued to allow him access to secret files and materials. Over the next several years, the Penkovsky case would become a cottage industry within the CIA, as every aspect of the operation was analyzed to determine what was accomplished and what went wrong. The Penkovsky operation had produced an astonishing amount of material. During his year and a half as an active agent, he supplied more than 100 cassettes of exposed Minox film, each containing 50 exposures or frames. The more than 140 hours of debriefings in London and Paris produced some 1,200 pages of transcripts and reams of handwritten pages. He identified hundreds of GRU and KGB officers from photos and provided Western intelligence officials with their first authoritative view of the highest levels of the post-Stalin Soviet Union. In fact, he supplied so much information that both the CIA and MI6 set up teams dedicated exclusively to processing the material, which resulted in an estimated 10,000 pages of intelligence reports. More than the quantity, the substance of the documents on the Minox film and his knowledgeable debriefings impressed both CIA and MI6. Penkovsky appeared at a crucial time during the Cold War when tensions and the potential for nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the West were at an apex. This volatility was heightened by a lack of certainty on each side about the intentions and capabilities of the other. The failed Soviet attempt to isolate the British, French, and U.S.-controlled sections of Berlin by blocking all ground and rail transportation and shipments into the city during 1948 and 1949 was still a fresh memory when the United States was caught off guard by unpredicted, assertive Soviet technological, military, and political actions beginning in 1957. The USSR launched Sputnik in 1957, shot down Francis Gary Powers' U-2 reconnaissance plane on May Day 1960,
and built the Berlin Wall in 1961. So anemic was U.S. intelligence access to the plans and intentions of the Kremlin that the text of Nikita Khrushchev's famous speech denouncing Stalin at the 20th Party Congress in 1956 came to the CIA via a third party, an Israeli source operating behind the Iron Curtain. Through the late 1950s, Khrushchev's seeming obsession with the United States was rising to dangerous levels. His fixation with U.S. objectives was fueled first by an alarmist 1960 KGB report that falsely described the Pentagon's intention to initiate war against the Soviet Union as soon as possible, followed by a failed attempt to overthrow Castro in 1961. Then, in 1962, two erroneous GRU intelligence reports warned of an imminent nuclear first strike on the Soviet Union by the United States. "Our production of rockets is like sausages coming from an automatic machine. Rocket after rocket comes off the assembly line," bragged Khrushchev. Penkovsky's assignment to the State Committee for the Coordination of Scientific Research Work granted him access to the highest levels of military circles. He, in turn, provided the West with a contrasting view of both Soviet capability and Khrushchev's belligerent stance. Khrushchev's threats are like swinging a club to see the reaction. If the reaction is not in his favor, he stops swinging, Penkovsky explained to the team in a Paris hotel room in 1961. For the Kennedy administration, Penkovsky's reporting put the lie to the Soviet leader's braggadocio, while the intelligence he provided, combined with overhead intelligence, influenced downward revisions of Soviet missile production in national intelligence estimates. Penkovsky also revealed the real dangers of diplomacy without independent and timely intelligence. As the Cuban Missile Crisis heated up, Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin used back-channel communication through Attorney General Robert Kennedy, Adlai Stevenson, and other White House officials to assure President Kennedy that only short-range defensive rather than offensive missiles were going into Cuba. Similar false assurances also flowed through the back channels of diplomacy from GRU Colonel Georgi Bolshakov, working undercover of the TASS news agency, through Robert Kennedy. However, the technical manuals provided by Penkovsky for the Soviet SS-4 medium-range ballistic missiles allowed CIA photo analysts to identify and match the deployment pattern or footprint with U-2 reconnaissance photos taken over San Cristobal, Cuba. Far from being defensive and of short range, the missiles were armed with 3,000-pound nuclear warheads and a range of some 1,000 nautical miles, and were more than capable of reaching Washington, D.C. and New York City. Finally, Penkovsky's information provided analysis of the Soviets' overall lack of preparedness for war, allowing President Kennedy to face off against Khrushchev during the crisis. His insights, derived from personal access to Kremlin leaders, added independent weight to technical evidence that Soviet military threats were overstated, if not hollow. The American president was emboldened to act and denied the Soviets a nuclear missile foothold in the Western Hemisphere. For that brief and critical moment in time, history turned on the material provided by one man, Oleg Penkovsky. In the wake of the Penkovsky case, the CIA undertook the unprecedented measure of bringing to press in 1965 the Penkovsky Papers. The agency, working with journalist Frank Gibney and the publisher Doubleday & Company, publicly exposed many of the operational aspects of the GRU revealed by Penkovsky. An immediate bestseller, the book presented most Americans with one of the first in-depth looks at Soviet intelligence operations in the West. The Penkovsky Papers offered remarkable details of Soviet tradecraft, from tips on American personal grooming and social customs — many Americans like to keep their hands in their pockets and chew gum — to evading surveillance and selecting dead drop sites. One section warned of the dangers presented by squirrels running off with small packages left at dead drop sites in New York's Central Park. For American readers, the book confirmed their worst suspicions that Soviet spies were active and successful in the United States. It may also have implied an equally aggressive and thriving U.S. espionage capability in the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, this was not the case. The few who understood how dependent American intelligence had been on Heroes production knew the time had come to change the game plan. The case had revealed grave deficiencies in the tradecraft needed to handle long-term agents inside the Soviet Union. America's technology and the CIA's Technical Services Division would become key players in a new operational strategy. Chapter 4. Beyond Penkovsky. Soviet intelligence is overconfident, overcomplicated, and overestimated. Alan Dulles, The Craft of Intelligence. In nearly every respect, the Penkovsky case was a traditional agent operation. Relying more on the professionalism of the agent and handler than gadgets, the tradecraft employed differed little from what was used during World War II, and some methods, such as signal sights, dated back to the Old Testament. Penkovsky was briefed and debriefed in hotel rooms in London and Paris. These were cordial working sessions that lasted hours, filling the rooms with cigarette smoke and then ending with the optimism of chilled wine and gracious toasts. In Moscow, Penkovsky used dead drops and brush passes to deliver his intelligence, and in one instance, used the overhead water tank of a toilet during a diplomatic function as a dead drop. Well-designed and properly executed dead drop exchanges are among the most secure means for agent communication. Brush passes, though less secure, are still relatively safe. However, Penkovsky conducted an excessive number of personal exchanges between October 1961 and January 1962, all with Mrs. Chisholm. Even more alarming, 11 of these exchanges were in public view, and some were poorly executed and transparent to surveillance teams. The KGB's 7th Directorate surveillance officers later commented that while surveilling Mrs. Chisholm and her children in a park off Tsvetnoy Boulevard in 1961, they observed an elderly man approach one of the children and proffer a small box of chocolates. The young girl took the present to her mother, who, without opening the box, placed it inside the baby carriage. To the KGB, the act was suspicious, and the elderly man was later identified as Penkovsky. Whatever shortcomings might have existed were not entirely without reason. There simply were no suitable devices on agency shelves for this type of operation. For instance, as late as 1962, the CIA had yet to develop a small, reliable document copy camera for agents. Rather, Penkovsky relied on the commercially available Minox Model 3S camera. Small enough to conceal inside a man's closed fist, the Minox boasted an excellent lens that easily captured images of letters, memos, and pages from a book, but could not be used covertly. The sliding shutter release required two hands, making it impossible to use inside an office or archive with anyone else present. Good pictures required even lighting, proper photo technique, and privacy. The only item Penkovsky used that could properly be called advanced tradecraft was his agent-receive communications through a one-way voice link. These encoded messages, known as OWVL, were broadcast over shortwave frequencies at predetermined times from a CIA-operated transmitter in Western Europe. Penkovsky listened to these messages on a Panasonic radio, strings of numbers read in a dispassionate voice, and then decoded them using a one-time pad. Although foreign consumer technology, such as the Panasonic radio, was rare in the Soviet Union, Penkovsky could display his openly in the small study of his apartment, since the radio raised no questions of disloyalty for a senior officer in his position. However, the system only received messages and left him without a means to send a reply. Penkovsky secreted his spy gear, one-time pads, Minox cameras, film, and commo plan, inside a clever homemade concealment built into a wooden desk in his study. All of this was eventually displayed in open court as proof of his covert activities. In sharp contrast to Penkovsky's basic spy gear was the sophisticated KGB technical surveillance operation that enveloped him after coming under suspicion. The KGB established three key points of observation to monitor his activities inside his home. The first was in the apartment directly above his, from which a KGB audio surveillance post monitored all conversations. A pinhole opening was drilled through the ceiling of his study from a monitoring post overhead and photographed Penkovsky with a special 35mm camera, codenamed LINOCK, while he worked at his desk. A second camera system, also from the apartment above, was mounted in the small balcony that overhung his window. Hidden in the concrete floor of this balcony was a camera and a small, remotely controlled trap door rigged to open and capture images as he photographed documents at the windowsill. The even light coming in through the open window, which overlooked the Moscow River, produced excellent images, and he never imagined anyone could observe his activities. The KGB set up a third observation post on the other side of the river in an apartment building facing Penkovsky's apartment at Naberezhnaya Maxima Gorkova, Maxim Gorky Embankment, 36, flat 59. From there, KGB cameras with telephoto lenses produced high-quality images of his photo sessions, even capturing Penkovsky at his desk as he monitored shortwave broadcasts and copied down the transmitted numbers. After action assessments following Penkovsky's roll-up focused attention on the absence of effective spy gear, particularly in the area of agent communications. While in Moscow, his communication channels to his handlers were limited to dead drops and brief meetings. Silent phone calls were no more than prearranged emergency signals. Technology did little to enhance either Penkovsky's production or security. His remarkable success was achieved not because of technology, but despite the lack of it. His official position allowed him periodic travel outside the USSR and opportunities for extensive debriefings. Without these personal meetings, Penkovsky would not have been successful. What became clear was that the CIA in the 1960s did not have the operational methodology, clandestine hardware, or personnel to run secure agent operations inside the USSR. The absence of a secure and clandestine means of communicating in Moscow forced both the agent and his handlers to take risks that eventually played into the hands of the KGB surveillance methods. The recruitment of agents inside the Soviet Union meant little if the KGB could quickly identify them or if they could not securely communicate the secrets to which they had access. For agents to be handled clandestinely in country, the CIA needed the means to detect and counter pervasive KGB surveillance before conducting an operation, to conduct secure impersonal communications, and to pass and receive materials securely from the agent. These were no small matters. In fact, a decade would pass before TSD and OTS engineers created the covert devices needed to conduct multiple sustained clandestine operations inside the USSR. Although neither side realized it at the time, Penkovsky's capture marked the start of a 15-year span during which the technological advantage would swing decisively in favor of the CIA. When Penkovsky volunteered to spy for the West, the CIA lacked the ability to handle him in Moscow. In contrast, the KGB and GRU packed Soviet embassies, consulates, trade organizations, trading companies, the United Nations, international organizations, and press offices around the world with intelligence officers and co-opted civilians, often to the annoyance of genuine diplomats. For the few U.S. intelligence officers who could get into the Soviet Union, operational success was nearly impossible. While the Soviets could not accurately identify every U.S. intelligence officer, the KGB erred on the side of caution and assumed that all Americans worked for the CIA until proven otherwise. The KGB's second chief directorate opened a file on each American and profiled each against age, gender, job description, personal activities,
and possible intelligence roles. The KGB also charted expected activity patterns to go along with the profile that included predictable routes of travel to and from work each day. Even noted were the wife's favorite place to shop or visit. Added to these were the necessary travel to sporting and cultural events, sightseeing, and social activities outside of work. They knew that activities outside the regular travel pattern could mask a more sinister purpose, such as an agent meeting, casing a site, or servicing a dead drop, and thus identify the suspect as an intelligence officer. Americans also quickly learned that, contrary to spy novels and James Bond movies, obvious attempts to evade surveillance only proved counterproductive. Any aggressive action to escape the surveillance teams set off alarms among the watchers of the 7th Directorate. The KGB penalized its surveillance officers for carelessness, which included losing a person under close observation. So taunting, antagonizing, or making the surveillance team's job more difficult could result in dog feces being rubbed on car door handles or a smashed windshield. Particularly unnerving for most American drivers was a technique called bumper lock, in which the surveillance car remained literally inches from one's rear bumper. Provocations were commonly employed. Soviets posing as disaffected or greedy officials volunteered information in an effort to engage the CIA. These individuals, aptly called dangles, made it both difficult and essential to verify the authenticity of potential agents. Fortunately for the West, some of the most significant agents proved remarkably persistent in the attempts to establish contact after their initial efforts were rebuffed. If such caution toward volunteers was understandable, it could also lead to disaster. In 1963, a former officer in the KGB's second chief directorate, Alexander Cherepanov, handed a package to a pair of American tourists visiting the Soviet Union. Agency opinion differed on whether the material was genuine or part of a provocation. At the time, there was simply no way to tell. The contents of the package, which provided details on KGB surveillance methods, were photographed and eventually handed back to the Soviets through diplomatic channels. Cherepanov, learning of the betrayal, fled Moscow. Eventually captured, he was tried in secret and executed in 1964. It is not possible to determine why the Americans betrayed Cherepanov, a KGB assessment observed. Either they suspected that his action was a KGB provocation, or they wanted to burden the KGB with a lengthy search for the person who had sent the package to the embassy. Americans were closely observed even inside their own Tchaikovsky Street embassy. A 10-story structure erected in the 1950s as an apartment complex in a Russian version of Beaux-Arts style, it was typical of Soviet Union architectural design. The interior represented Soviet construction of the day, featuring a claustrophobic maze of narrow halls and small rooms. American diplomats had been in the building since 1952, when Stalin ordered a move from Mochevaya Street near the Kremlin and the National Hotel to a more remote location. Had the Americans stalled, as the British managed to do, the move might have been unnecessary, as Stalin died a short time later. Extensive renovation by the American occupants produced only limited improvements. American construction crews discovered that the walls and floors were insulated with sawdust, ash, and other debris from the original construction. Seemingly installed as an afterthought, the electrical wiring would have been state-of-the-art in the 1920s, but was inadequate for the power requirements of modern appliances. Soviet citizens employed as workers by the U.S. Embassy had access to all but the most sensitive areas of the building. Working in low-level administrative, maintenance, or service positions, they reported on personal habits, personality types, and office gossip to the KGB. During the 1960s and 1970s, Russian nationals equaled or outnumbered American citizens working in the Moscow embassy. Conversely, the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C., did not employ a single American citizen. The presence of so many Soviet citizens, a large percentage of them no doubt co-optees or informers,
was not without its amusing moments. For two decades, a vivacious woman known as Valentina ran the barbershop and beauty salon in the embassy's basement.